In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Headlines read from the corporate-owned Fourth Estate that this pandemic is a humanitarian disaster that's out of control. Is it not clear that the corporate-owned Mockingbird Media has almost single-handedly created a living nightmare for the majority of humans? For some reason, New World Order takeover, the leaders in this country have decided to ignore the reports showing that the RT-PCR test is 90% inaccurate, yet it's still used. How much longer will the people in this country allow their leadership to conveniently use an error-prone device, giving the false positives necessary for timely lockdowns? We've been told by doctors and scientists that the PCR testing system should not be used to determine infection. And Dr. Anthony Fauci is one of those doctors. On the globalresearch.ca site, there's an article that references a July 2020 podcast titled This Week in Virology, where Tony Fauci makes a point of saying the PCR COVID test is useless and misleading when the test is run at, quote, 35 cycles or higher. A positive result indicating infection cannot be accepted or believed. Each, quote, cycle of the test is a quantum leap in amplification and magnification of the test specimen taken from the patient. Too many cycles, and the test will run up all sorts of irrelevant material that will be wrongly interpreted as relevant. That's called a false positive. What Fauci failed to say on the video is the FDA, which authorizes the test for public use, recommends the test should be run up to 40 cycles, not 35. Therefore, all labs in the U.S. that follow the FDA guideline are knowingly or unknowingly participating in fraud. Fraud on a monstrous level because millions of Americans are being told they are infected with the virus on the basis of a false positive result. And the total number of COVID cases in America, which is based on the test, is a gross falsity. The lockdowns and other restraining measures are based on these fraudulent case numbers. Fauci says the test is useless when it's run at 35 cycles or higher. The FDA says run the test up to 40 cycles in order to determine whether the virus is there. Let's hear part of an interview with Dr. Anthony Fauci on Professor Vincent Racanella's very informative YouTube channel. Dr. Vincent is a virology professor. Let's have a listen.
All right. There have been a number of reports of patients who shed viral RNA for weeks, as determined by PCR. Doesn't seem to be infectious virus. And the real question is, are they a threat for transmission? And I'm wondering if you think we could use a cutoff of viral loads determined by PCR to say this patient is no longer infectious, can go home, can go to a nursing facility. Because right now the physicians are really having a hard time with that.
Right. Again, a good question. And what is now sort of evolving into a bit of a standard that if you get a cycle threshold of 35 or more, that the chances of it being replication competent are minuscule. Mm. So that if somebody, and you know, we have patients, and it's very frustrating for the patients as well as for the physicians. Somebody comes in and they repeat their PCR and it's like 37 cycle threshold. But you almost never can culture virus. Yeah. From a 37 threshold cycle. So I think if somebody does come in with 37, 38, even 36, you got to say, you know, it's just dead nucleotides, period.
Mm. Yeah, because as you know, we can't easily culture infectious virus. You don't have a BSL-3 lab everywhere.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay. So is the threshold cycle is reporting out a pretty standard practice in doing a diagnosis now rather than just positive or negative? Okay, good.
Yeah, I mean, if when you go in, when I get my test, you know, it's negative. When someone comes in and it's positive, they don't give them the threshold until you go back and ask for it.
Okay. But they've got it.
They've got it. Right. They've got it.
So what's your current perspective on the fraction of transmission now that's either asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic versus symptomatic?
You know, Richard, I know you're going to ask that. Yeah, I like these questions because there's no right or wrong answer because we don't know.
That was part of an interview with Dr. Anthony Fauci on Professor Vincent Racchianello's YouTube channel. Why do you think the educated and informed people within the state and institutions believe it's okay to allow PCR high cycle testing to continue when they know it would yield false positives? Is it because there's a well-coordinated network of people doing the bidding of a larger international agenda? An agenda aimed at crushing the economies of first world countries. And then what can you expect? We also know that face masks don't help. That's proven. The virus moves through a face mask like sand through a chain link fence. So the testing system is exploited. The face masks aren't useful, and now states are making their move for mandatory vaccines. Remember what past guest Michigan attorney David Helm said about laws protecting against mandatory vaccines. Let's have a listen.
So when it comes to COVID right now, there are no laws mandating vaccines, primarily because we don't have any effective vaccines right now. And I heard recently that Johnson & Johnson just stopped their testing of the vaccine because several people were getting sick, really sick from it. So the likelihood of us having a vaccine anytime soon is slim. But there is definitely talk of making these vaccines mandatory. The problem with that is, from a constitutional point of view, is we have, I would say, a very bad ruling from 100 years ago called the Jacobson case. And that involved a mandatory vaccine dealing with smallpox. And there was an outbreak, there was quarantine areas, and there was a mandatory vaccine. That case has been cited by every governor in this country, saying that they have the authority to take all these draconian measures in order to stop the spread of COVID. And for the most part, this was a Supreme Court case. So for the most part, the courts have been upholding this, saying that this is precedent. It was specifically mentioned in the Pennsylvania case, though, and it distinguished Jacobson from today in that we have had a huge advancement on individual liberties since the Jacobson ruling 100 years ago. We have, in fact, even Roe v. Wade was a huge blow to what the principles set forth in Jacobson are. The principles set forth in Jacobson were that the vaccine is minimally invasive, it's been proven to be effective, and there is a dangerous communicable disease out there, and it also took into consideration, the mandate did anyways, of people's health and age. Like, they weren't vaccinating kids and or the elderly or people that were susceptible to, you know, becoming sick from the vaccine. It was only healthy adults that were being vaccinated. That was the Jacobson case. But since then, we have Roe v. Wade, which is, and its companion cases going forward from that, which are huge individual privacy cases involving one's privacy to their own body, to the extent that the government can't mandate vaccines the way they did under Jacobson 100 years ago. And to my knowledge, there are no mandatory vaccine laws right now. There are requirements, especially when you're talking about children and going to school, but there's also the waivers available and things like that, which used to be religious-based only, that you could get a waiver for it, but now it's been expanded to beyond just a religious challenge to the vaccines. And so since there are those laws, and since Jacobson is way out of date, and since we have Roe v. Wade and all the companion cases that go from there, I don't see a situation where the governments are going to be able to mandate vaccines. Even if we have a completely functional and completely harmless vaccine for COVID, I don't see it being mandated, at least not lawfully. And I would expect challenges, and we're prepared to challenge that if Michigan ever tries to impose such a mandate.
But let's hear more about what vaccine corporations are doing and how Anthony Fauci is, among many things, profiting off of royalties from university patents. This is part of an interview from Robert F. Kennedy's Truth Channel, and his guest is Dr. David Martin. The highlights of this conversation include breaking down Dr. David Martin's company, M-CAM, and how he found a way to put up intangible assets as collateral security. Another highlight is the Bayne-Dole Act that led to Fauci profiting from the royalties off university patents, Fauci working for the NIAID but failing to study infectious disease and allergies, Fauci involved in price-fixing medicine in the U.S., and the SARS vaccine patent in March 2019, 8 months before the COVID-19 outbreak. Let's have a listen.
Theoretically promoted is by saying that, as Bill Gates said, who is one of the funders of Moderna, that it will turn the human cell into a vaccine manufacturing factory. And right. So tell me if I got that right and continue.
Yeah. So let's answer the beginning question. What we had to do for our business is we actually have to monitor every patent that issues anywhere on earth. So the fact of the matter is our business has to look at whether or not people say they have what they said they have. So let's take Moderna as an example. In August of 2010, when Moderna filed its first patent, to your point, their goal was to turn the human cell into its own pharmaceutical company. The idea was if you put mRNA into a particular delivery agent, and the agent that they talked about was a lipid, you could get that mRNA to go into the cell to alter the way in which the cell works. So one of a couple things can happen. The cell itself could manufacture proteins or protein fragments inside of itself to achieve certain outcomes. And if we go back and look at what Moderna's primary thrust was when it started, Bobby, it was actually a cancer treatment, not a vaccine. This started off as a way to treat and potentially work on targeting cancer cells. And it was only after a series of very, very noteworthy false starts where they tried to get stuff done that didn't work that suddenly people said, well, hold on a minute, couldn't we essentially turn cells into their own vaccine producing kind of regimens? But all of the theory is that if you introduce these fragments of mRNA, you can get a protein expression or a fraction of a protein expression that is going to do something to the cell to either promote a new action by the cell. That could be blocking the cell from receiving certain antigens coming in. It could be actually producing a series of proteins which would combat an infective agent. And in the case of cancer, which is where they started their primary focus, it was about altering the way in which cells proliferated, because they thought maybe they could actually build essentially an oncology treatment where the cell itself becomes the producer of the thing that could blow up cancer. So that's what they did. But here's the problem. The problem is the core technology that they built this on came out of a National Science Foundation, not an NIH. It started at National Science Foundation grant. The core technology that was represented in what started Moderna was published in August of 2009, 1 year before Moderna filed its first patent. And one of the most important things to understand about this company is it was founded by one individual appropriating technology that U.S. taxpayers paid for through the National Science Foundation and deciding to individually and personally profit from that by essentially expropriating information from the work that was paid for with the National Science Foundation grant, wrapping it up in a company where he would become one of the co-founders. Interestingly enough, illegally naming the two venture capitalists as co-inventors. They had nothing to do with the invention, but he named them as co-inventors. And the company got off to the races in 2010, in the late summer of 2010, as a company founded on misappropriated technology, appropriated for the purpose of personal enrichment. And as you've seen, over the now 140 patents and patent applications that Moderna has prosecuted, not once have they followed the law and identified the fact that they are in fact beholden to federal government grants for all of the things that they develop. They're violating the Bayh-Dole Act, the 1980 Bayh-Dole Act, in every single one of their patent filings. This company has been operating as an illegal operation from the beginning. And it's not surprising that their apologist in chief, their advocate in chief, is none other than Tony Fauci, who has every bit of an interest in seeing their vaccine jump to the front of the line because NIAID has its vested interest in seeing it succeed.
Right. And Tony Fauci has put in $2.48 billion U.S. taxpayer dollars into this venture.
At least. What we know is that he has put several appropriated and non-competing grants. And most of your viewers don't understand the difference between a competitive grant, which is a researcher who has to file a grant application. They're up against all kinds of other grant applications. They're competing for funds. Moderna has received non-competing funds, meaning they don't have to prove anything. They don't have to do anything. They don't even have to tell you really what the money is going to be used for. It's like getting blank check authorizations. And we know that since 2005, roughly $1.7 billion a year, $1.7 billion a year, has gone through the DARPA-funded bioweapon and biopreparedness program through NIAID. NIAID is the administrator of that $1.7 billion a year. And much of that has gone into a variety of programs that ultimately landed at Moderna.
So let me give people kind of a little bit of a background on Tony Fauci. Tony Fauci came to out of his internship. Since his internship ended in 1968, he's never treated a patient. He's a doctor, but he's a doctor who doesn't see patients. He went directly to NIAID. He then became the head of NIAID in 1984, at the very time that the HIV epidemic exploded. And what Tony Fauci does, NIAID is supposed to look for the causes and also treatments for infectious diseases, for allergic diseases, and autoimmune diseases. Tony Fauci does almost none of those things. What he's done is he's taken an enormous budget that began with the AIDS budget, which is now about $6 billion a year, plus another $1.7 billion a year that he gets from the Defense Department, which becomes part of his discretionary spending. And he invests that money in developing new drugs. And he farms the money out to about 1,300 principal investigators who run their own little empires at Harvard, at NYU, at Berkeley, at MIT. And they begin the drug development for him. They do the clinical studies. And then when it gets to a certain point, he sells the drug or transfers it to one of the big pharmaceutical companies. But he does a deal with them where he splits the royalties for many of these drugs. So he has now, David mentioned the Bayh-Dole Act. The Bayh-Dole Act, I believe, was passed in 84, but you may be right. It may have been passed a little earlier than that.
Yeah, it was debated in 1979, signed into law in 1980.
All right. And what that act did was it said for the first time, it said it used to be that if the government developed a new technology or a new drug, it became part of the public domain and anybody could use it, that there was no patent for it and you couldn't patent it. The Bayh-Dole Act changed that, and it was a good intention. It was saying, you know, we're going to give our universities and we're going to give NIH the ability to patent things so that the money that the industry is making on them, on taxpayer-funded projects, some of that money can come back to NIH Some of it can go to the universities where there were brilliant scientists who could be working for private industry, but instead they're working in academic fields and they're doing pure research, and we want to reward them so they're not walking around in tweed jackets with leather elbow pads and can't afford anything. We're going to actually give them, you know, a reward for their labor. The problem was, and you correct me if I'm wrong here, because I still don't understand how this happened, that HHS interpreted the Bayh-Dole Act not only to allow the academic scientists to collect money and the academic institutions like Harvard and MIT, which are making billions of dollars now on royalties, technologies that were created by their scientists, but also HHS interpreted to allow individual scientists within the agencies who use taxpayer money and worked for some period on these projects to also file a patent on the projects and then collect royalties. And at that time, it was unlimited royalties. And I think actually there was a scandal involving Tony Fauci with interleukin. He owned a patent for a drug called interleukin, and it came to Congress's attention because an internal HHS investigation found that a lot of the trial subjects in that study were getting very sick, and they were dying, and there was suicidal ideation, and that Fauci had not told them of that risk when he was recruiting them.
Right.
And during the process of that investigation, it became clear that Fauci owned a patent for interleukin. And people were saying, wow, you know, this guy isn't telling people the risks of this. He's going to make a lot of money on it. And at that time, he told Congress and he told the AP, oh, don't worry, I always plan to give that money to charity. But he never told how much. We have no idea to this day how much money he's made on that or how many patents he owns.
Right.
And he could own patents. He could own thousands. Well, I think there are, you know, over 1,000 patents that he funded development of. We have no idea.
Close to 2,600 that they acknowledge. I think it's 2,655 that they acknowledge. And they have another approximately 1,000 that we've tracked where the grants they've given have given rise to a patent, which is where they would have, to your point, they would have march-in rights. So
let me just, somewhere in the neighborhood of
3,500 patents.
Let me just finish painting this portrait of what Fauci does. So this is a federal agency that is supposed to tell us why, where's the autism coming from? This all happened under Tony Fauci's watch. When he came in 84, the chronic disease rate in our country was 12.8%. By 2006, it had gone up to 54%. Those are autoimmune diseases. Those are allergic diseases. That's right in his wheelhouse. That is his expertise. He's supposed to be an autoimmune expert. He does not spend a penny trying to figure out what environmental toxin and exposure is causing this epidemic of disease. Instead, he has transformed NIAID, his agency, into the primary incubator or the pharmaceutical industry for new products. So he creates the products, he sells it to them, he transfers it to them for very, very beneficial prices. And he gets it, he walks it through the FDA approval process, which means then Medicare and Medicaid have to pay for that drug. He helps negotiate those deals and get beneficial deals with the drug companies. And then the money comes back to him and his staff through royalties. And so instead of researching and trying to stop all these chronic diseases from happening to our children, he's ignoring all of that and simply essentially printing money. And let me tell you how important this is. In between 2009 and 2016, there were hundreds of drugs approved by FDA, and every single one of them came out of Tony Fauci's shop. So that is the impact he has had on the pharmaceutical industry. He, during his tenure, the chronic disease rate has gone from 12% to 54%. We now use more drugs than any country in the world. We pay the highest prices for those drugs, and the drug industry is now controlling our government. And Tony Fauci, the reason he's lasted there for 50 years is he's like a mix between Bernie Madoff, which we can see in this Moderna racket,
yep,
J. Edgar Hoover. J. Edgar Hoover lasted for 50 years. He's the only other guy who's lasted for 50 years as an agency head, because he was using that agency to benefit big shots, to make sure the mafia didn't get prosecuted, to make sure that people, dissidents, people he didn't like would be spied on, like Martin Luther King and others, to bribe and blackmail, you know, big shots and files on everybody, and to make friends, yep, in big places. And the Tony Fauci has done played the same game. And you've seen what he did, you know, how this is a Ponzi scheme, this Moderna vaccine.
There's no question.
Nobody in the world that would buy this vaccine if they knew what you and I know about it. It does not stop the disease. It has a huge injury rate. It does not stop transmissibility. And he has a $9 billion contract with the Pentagon for 500 million doses. How did he get that, by the way?
Well, so, but this is a thing. And this is where, you know, would that the generation that preceded you still be around where you could actually pick up the phone and call an AG and say, there's a crime. This is a crime, and I think we need to stop dancing around the edge of it and call it what it is. Anthony Fauci's behavior is racketeering. He controls the means of production. He allocates the market beneficiaries, to your point. He picks the winners and losers. That's an illegal thing to do. That's an antitrust thing to do. That's a criminal conspiracy. He is actually picking winners and losers, and then, just to add insult to injury, he's doing the price fixing, right? Think about what happens when you negotiate a price where you, in fact, are a vested interest in that negotiation. There's no public interest being served. This is a violation of his standard practice as a federal officer, because he's actually not acting in good faith. He is, in fact, price fixing. So you have the market allocation, a definition of antitrust. You have the interlocking directorate problem, which sounds sophisticated, but it isn't. He runs the shop on the organizations that declare the problem. He mysteriously always has the solution in hand. I mean, people need to know that we've got, you know, COVID 2.0 on the books right now. Suddenly, polio is back. Suddenly, the threat of acute transverse myelitis is back. Suddenly the threat of a whole bunch of other things that allegedly his 50 years at the helm of infectious disease managed, these are all coming back. And if you go back and you look at the patent record of his funded research, you realize he controls the pathogen. He then controls the means of detection and the means of therapy. And then he controls the price that it's going to get sold at, and he gets paid every step along the way. This is Chicago Mafia 1920s. And the worst thing is we now have a situation where justice isn't being served because, to your point, Bobby, the government controlled by pharmaceuticals has no incentive to actually address this problem. So we're going to see a rush to approve an untested and unproven. And the reason, by the way, it's untested and unproven is because every time they started down the pathway of a safety trial, it blew up. Moderna's technology was bad technology. That's why in 10 years they didn't produce a drug. It's not because the technology was speculative. It was because the technology literally harmed the things that they put it in. And so the reason why we don't have a drug from Moderna is for a good reason. They haven't produced anything that's safe. And now we're going to whitewash that because we've got the guy who's writing the check to support it, who's now on the other side.
You know, my son worked for a financial firm. And they called me up and they said, well, you know, what do you think of these vaccines? Because they were, you know, thinking of betting on them or shorting on them. And they wanted to know, I knew a lot about it. And they were asking me, which ones are the good ones? And I said, you know, I don't know that. I know about the top four. And they all have really serious problems. But I watched during this whole time, I know all these problems. You know, the Moderna vaccine had in the clinical trial, the phase one trial, they had three in the high dose group, 21% of the people get injuries that required medical intervention or hospitalization. So you give that to a billion people and, you know, you're hospitalizing 21% of them. And they had, that's basically the entire population of the United States.
Right.
And you give, and the low dose group had 6%, which is a dose related response, which is one of the indicators for profound toxicity. Then when they gave the second shot, 100% of the people had some illness. So why would you give that? Why would you give that to children, for example, where 99% of children don't even know that they have it? Why would you give them something that has 100% injury rate? And, you know, I look at that and I say, this thing is dead on arrival. But at the same time that all this data were coming out, I was watching the market cap of this product go through the roof. How high did it get? The market cap.
Well, listen, they ran it up almost over the course of Anthony Fauci's promotion, the market cap doubled in the space of about 14 trading days.
Went up to like 35 billion or something, right?
Yeah.
Or even more. And I was looking at this and saying, how is this possible? How could people on Wall Street be so stupid? And then I realized what happened. Tony Fauci has a secret contract with the Pentagon to buy, which I posted on my Instagram 12 days ago, you can go look at it, to buy 500 million doses for $9 billion. And what that means is it doesn't matter if it works or not. It doesn't matter if it hospitalizes 20% of the people who take it.
No.
All he has to do is get FDA approval. And the day he gets FDA approval, that $9 billion is his. And it's an easy thing for him to get FDA approval and then just never sell any vaccines. The whole thing is such a sick, demented, and crooked scheme. But, you know, now that I know his life, I see that this is what he's been doing for 50 years at NIAID. Did the same thing with AZT. Did the same thing with remdesivir.
Yeah.
He did. Yeah. This is what he does.
Well, and you look at remdesivir. I mean, Gilead Sciences, when they actually,
which, by the way, Gilead is one of Gates' huge investments. So that's
of course. Yep. Yeah. So and the whole cabal that's been part of the Moderna story has also been part of the Gilead story. This is actually another DARPA and NIAID funded racket. But if you look at that one, you know, the fact of the matter is there is not a chance that we would have an approval outside of the emergency use authorization. This whole medical countermeasures, the MCM, if people want to go and look at these things, the whole medical countermeasure approach to the declaration of a state of emergency and then the fast tracking of therapies to try to address those states of emergency all have conflicted financial interests. There has not been, and this violates, by the way, the 21 Code of Federal Regulations. If people want to go back, the Code of Federal Regulations that governs the FDA has a provision that says that there are, in fact, ways to expedite processes during a national emergency, an epidemic, or a pandemic. So there is a provision in the 21 Code of Federal Regulations that actually gives FDA the authorization to do this. But to do it, it has to be reviewed and approved by an independent institutional review board, an ethics committee, that has no financial interest in the outcome. That body has to be impaneled, and then that body has to meet, review the evidence, and approve it. Otherwise, you cannot do what they're doing. So they're even violating the provisions of the emergency use authorization. There has not been an independent, and by independent, this means the test of independence. Are you prepared to actually have no financial interest? And the fact of the matter is this whole racket has been architected by people who actually have allocated the market, have interlocked their directorates, and ultimately price fixed. This is a criminal operation. It has been, it continues to be. And not surprisingly, where's Gilead? None other than one of the big donors to Governor Gavin Newsom. Why is Gavin so insistent on making sure that the state of California feels the pain of this virus? Well, it turns out that he's getting paid by the people who are getting paid for him keeping the virus going.
You know, there's one thing that you found that is of immense interest to people, which is the patent application from, I think it's 2016. It has language in it that says, we need this application right away because in case there's an accidental or deliberate release of a coronavirus. What is the legitimate explanation for that having for that line having gotten into the patent?
Yeah, so let's go ahead and read it just so that we have it in the record. This is actually in four patent applications. The patent applications started in 2016. The edit to this patent application was done in March of 2019. Everybody will recall March of 2019 in the calendar in 2019 precedes December. So it's important that we establish for the record that March is before November and December. And the quote was, because of a concern for the reemergence or the deliberate release of SARS coronavirus, vaccine development was initiated. And that is written in four Moderna patent applications, March 28th of 2019. So, and by the way, the past tense there is very important. Vaccine development was initiated. To write that sentence in March means that somebody actually had reason to believe that there was going to be a reemergence or deliberate release of SARS in March, such that vaccine development was initiated, past tense, March 2019.
If you asked the Moderna people, what would they say? There's got to be some legitimate, you know, pretense of a legitimate explanation for this.
No, and this is where you know, Bobby, that a lawyer sits there and says, this is a discovery. This is a discovery waiting to happen, right? This is the kind of thing you love to do when you know you've got a criminal on the ropes and you know the answer before you ask the question, right? The first law of any question in law school, know the answer before you ask the question. There is a memo somewhere that gave rise to that sentence. And given the fact that that memo has to exist, because somebody not only used that language in March of 2019, but that language was then replicated at least four times in international gatherings, including the Global Preparedness Monitoring Board with the World Health Organization, including Event 201. The language, a accidental deliberate release of SARS coronavirus, was specifically language used, which means this came from a written script. And we know the script has its first evidentiary basis in March of 2019. So somewhere before March of 2019, Anthony Fauci knows that there is a memo that he hopes never sees the light of day.
We don't know that Anthony Fauci was involved with that application, do we?
Well, we know that Anthony Fauci would have been somewhere involved in this because Anthony Fauci was the one who violated the moratorium on gain of function in 2016 in partnership with the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, to take the Wuhan virus and a number of strains of coronavirus and mutate them and create, and I quote, synthetic chimeric variations of the Wuhan COV in 2016 during the moratorium. and he was the one that paid for it, which gave rise to the CDC and to all of the nonprofits that hold pathogens having on file the Wuhan virus before there was ever a wet lab or a wet market anywhere in Wuhan, China, in December of 2019.
Yeah, what David Martin is talking about here is that Tony Fauci, for many years, since I think 2002, has been experimenting with what is called gain-of-function studies, which are, are studies where wild viruses, viruses that exist in nature, flu viruses, MERS viruses, and in this case, coronavirus, are manipulated usually through by passing them through substrates made of different species. So they take coronavirus from the anus of a bat and they put it on pangolin tissue and it's teaching them to jump to pangolins, and then they use cocker spaniel tissue and they teach it to jump to dogs, and the ones that survive that and that flourish are the ones that are most transmissible, and then ultimately they transfer to lung tissue from human fetuses, and that takes the final step and teaches it to jump to human beings. And once they teach it that, they can use it on animals, on mice or on rats that have been genetically engineered to include human DNA. And they can then study the transmissibility of the virus, and they can also study whether a vaccine works. It's used for vaccine development. It's also used as a bioweapon. And usually the labs that do vaccine development, this kind of vaccine development, are also in the same lab as are the bioweapons. And that's bioweapons development. And Tony Fauci was doing a lot of them, as you mentioned, at the University of North Carolina and elsewhere in our country. President Obama, I think 200 scientists wrote him a letter after there'd been some laboratory escapes in 2014 and said, you got to stop Tony Fauci from doing these. This could turn into a worldwide pandemic, coronavirus pandemic. And Obama ordered him to stop, and we don't understand exactly what he did, but we know that he began outsourcing. He took the scientists that were working on this in North Carolina and he sent them to China, and he funded them with hundreds of millions of dollars $3.7 million, excuse me, not hundreds of millions, but at least one $3.7 million payment, and apparently more.
Much more.
Yeah.
And they
transferred the work to Wuhan, which is weird because it is a bioweapon, and the Red Army, the Chinese Army, controls that Wuhan lab. So he was teaching the Chinese how to make a pandemic coronavirus a bioweapon.
Yeah, but remember that in 2016, so right in the middle of the moratorium, because remember the moratorium went into effect in 2014-15, and then it was lifted in 2017. But right in the middle of that period, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, met with their ethics committee and decided that it was ethical to take Wuhan virus, a sample that came from a clinical outbreak that was apparently six guano miners, the bat dung miners in China, in Wuhan. Six of them allegedly came down with a set of symptoms.
In Wuhan, I want to make that clear that in Wuhan, there are no bats.
No. The actual name of the isolation was the Wuhan virus one. The actual name of the thing that was the subject of a master's thesis that was data collected in 2013 and 14 and isolated in 2015, that virus was actually transferred to the U.S. So we got a Chinese virus brought to the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill during the gain-of-function moratorium, and the UNC Chapel Hill Review Committee, the ethics committee there, decided to overrule the gain-of-function moratorium and allow for the chimeric synthetic recombinant use of that virus in North Carolina in 2016. So right in the middle of the moratorium was not only not enforced, but UNC Chapel Hill's leadership said, we're going to willfully ignore the will of the National Institutes of Health. We're going to willfully ignore that statement that was made about the prohibition of gain-of-function research. We are going to override all of that, and we're going to approve research which takes a Chinese pathogen, combines it with U.S. technology that was derived entirely from the gain-of-function research, and we're going to make a synthetic chimeric combination of the Wuhan virus. 2016. I mean, when the law doesn't apply, when ethics don't apply, when morality doesn't apply, and then the funding sources for all of that information put information into the commercial labs that have commercial pathogens for sale. And Bobby, you and I have talked about this, where the federal government, through a series of kind of quasi-shell corporations that look a lot like nonprofits, but they're not, they're actually run for profit, where you dial up the pathogen you want, you can buy it. And so it's not surprising that when Moderna heard about the SARS-CoV-2, they knew who to call to get a jump on what is the actual strain of the pathogen that we should be focused on for the vaccine development. And that's why I'm saying that the likelihood that says that if that sentence in March of 2019, if the sentence that said SARS-CoV vaccine development was initiated, that means Moderna had to get either with the CDC or with NIAID, because they're the only two places you could buy the primer of the pathogen. They had to know it, which means somebody at one of those two organizations, likely both, knows the source of that sentence.
This is part of an interview from Robert F. Kennedy's Truth Channel, and his guest is Dr. David Martin. And regarding the 2020 election voting fraud and manipulation cases, a recent report shows that software used by the voting system Dominion reportedly glitched in favor of Joe Biden in key parts of Michigan. According to this OAR News report, key members of Dominion have ties that trace back to Hillary Clinton. In their social media dispatch, it reads, Dominion deleted 2.7 million Trump votes nationwide. Data analysis finds 221,000 Pennsylvania votes switched from President Trump to Biden. 941,000 Trump votes deleted. States using Dominion voting system switched 435,000 votes from Trump to Biden. It's also reported that Dianne Feinstein's husband owns 60% of Dominion voting machines. In an article written by Joe Hoft, Open Records Requests finds no invoice or work orders on reported Election Day water main break in Atlanta. The president now holds 232 Electoral College votes to Biden's 226. The president has won 25 states to Biden's 19. There are six states still in question. That's Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Georgia, Nevada, and Arizona. In an article on the website Gold, Goats, and Guns, and this is leaning libertarian, it reads, The revolution in the U.S. is proceeding according to script. We are into the third act. Act one was the corona apocalypse, setting the stage for vastly expanded government powers and the systemic undermining of the sitting president. Act two was the summer of violence and fake polling data, which created the illusion of a society at war with that same president for not addressing the needs of the people. Underneath the headlines, the forces arrayed against Trump were building the infrastructure to ensure that however the people voted on November 3rd, the outcome was predetermined in their favor against him. Act 3 is the election itself and the aftermath. The coup has begun. The pressure campaign to force the incumbent Trump, hated by the establishment, to concede has ratcheted up to 11. This is all very normal for revolutions. Just ask Alexander Lukashenko in Belarus or Viktor Yanukovych, formerly of the Ukraine. We can't ask Slobodan Milosevic. He's dead. But one thing happened they didn't count on. Trump actually winning the election by margins in swing states that couldn't be overcome without overt and blatant fraud. That's created the opportunity for a complete reversal of current results and a successful countering of the revolution strategy, which rests on a media-made frenzy supported by foreign government leaders to oust the sitting president from power quickly without proper adherence to the process. And that feeds the plot points for the next 8 weeks until Congress convenes to certify or not the Electoral College. President Trump refuses to concede the election, and rightly so. There are multiple paths to not only victory for him, but also exposing the deep corruption of the election process and the people who control it. Lukashenko survived the revolution in Belarus because the attempt there was ham-fisted. It lacked the ingredients necessary to pull it off, identitarian division within the people, and corporate sponsorship. The conditions weren't ripe for that kind of result. All he had to do was offer reforms once the energy died down and make peace with Russia, and he would survive. Ousting him from power may not have been the primary goal, but achieving the secondary goal of severing EU and US ties to it and forcing Russia to devote resources to Belarus is almost as important. So, if Trump wants to lead the nation, he has to show it by fighting tooth and claw, just like Lukashenko did, and that means organizing support for him across the country. This is why he is incredibly smart to organize rallies. And there's an insert of part of an article from the website Axios. Quote, President Trump plans to brandish obituaries of people who supposedly voted but are dead, plus hold campaign-style rallies in an effort to prolong his fight against apparent insurmountable election results. Four Trump advisors told me during a conference call this afternoon. And it goes back to the article here. Insurmountable election results, really? A few thousand votes separates Trump from outright sweeping all the battleground states whose vote totals are very sketchy, and this is, quote, insurmountable. A lot of the corporate-owned media articles writing about this also said that there was no voter fraud evidence. And the article continues, this is what I mean by the pressure campaign having gone plaid. There is no responsible journalism left within the major media outlets. Only those who were forced out on principle or corruption have the ability to speak their mind now. And he includes a tweet by Megyn Kelly. And she writes, Martina, the vitriol went well beyond Trump. Some 70 million people have been called vile, bigots, racists, and xenophobes, and are now being threatened with being put on target lists as punishment for supporting him. They've been demonized by the very people now sanctimoniously demanding civility. Back to the article. Never in a million years would I look to Megyn Kelly for the voice of rationality, but it looks like being excommunicated from the inner circle does wonders for one's ability to tell the truth. The division today was cynically stoked and nurtured for this current operation to affect this exact result. The bigger point, Megyn, doesn't articulate it that this division is exactly the kind of, quote, secondary goal desired if Trump prevails in the courts or through the Electoral College. Regardless of the outcome, that division cuts deep enough to ensure an America permanently weakened, ripe for a complete remaking into a hellish place. There is a full court press on right now across the world to attack sovereignty of important states whose populations are dissident to the Davos crowd's Great Reset, notably the UK, the US, Poland, and Russia. Trump's fight is their fight. His supporters and sovereigntists of all stripes are to be ritualistically humiliated by every headline, every utterance, every tweet, and every newscast between now and when the state legislatures meet to select states of electors in December. The media will never concede they are wrong, will never report on anything fairly. They are in on the grift, looking for them to admit anything is a waste of energy and time, simply turn them off and become ungovernable. This is a psychological war now, designed to rob you of your reason and sap your willingness to fight by creating an overwhelming picture of Trump as the bad guy, chaotically clinging to power. We're being told he's already lost. But Megyn Kelly is right in telling people that there will be no reconciliation without acceptance, and since, at its core, leftism is a religion without the ability to forgive. Since it is vehemently anti-Christian, there will be no acceptance back into the fold, including for her. It will be marginalization, retribution, and continued vitriol of all Trump supporters and anyone not down with being reset into the grand vision of the new Soviet Green Man. And that is the Agenda 21, Agenda 2030, the big reset, transformation, and the Green New Deal, dot, dot, dot. It just keeps going from there. Klaus Schwab told you this: you'll own nothing and be happy, or else. The choice was struggle, Sessions, or Trump rallies. I told you months ago you would be faced with the Hobsons' choice of accepting their dystopic future or having your house burned down. Millions chose poorly last week, and they will have massive buyer's remorse as the plans are rolled out and they are sacrificed. Don't believe me? Ask Ukrainians if they're better off 6 years after their revolution or not. That one was successful. Act 3 of the revolution is the most dangerous. It is the one where chaos can reign for months and the balance tipped by the slimmest of margins. But in the end, it always comes down to the willingness of the people to decide their future. Because taking down the U.S. is such a monumental undertaking, they had to create a problem global in scale, COVID-19. The U.S. has everything against it in this situation. The oligarchy and its quislings are firmly in command of the narrative. There are real, deep divisions to keep people fighting each other while the oligarchs proceed with their plans. Trump is trying to marshal a counter-revolution on the grounds and in the courts. The evidence will be presented. Apparatchiks will ignore their orders. Protests will miraculously spring up in all the right places. The media will misrepresent everything. It will be up to us to decide which way the state legislatures decide whose electors go to Washington, D.C. next month by putting real pressure on them to act on their conscience and the evidence. That's the law. But the menace of it is real, and it won't go away regardless of the outcome of the election. It no longer lurks in the shadows. It slouches toward Washington, waiting to be reborn. So it was written by Tom Luongo, publisher of Gold, Goats, and Guns, Ruminations on Geopolitics, Markets, and Goats. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.